opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
Hello. Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Punkonomics on a Wednesday. And Dr. Benjamin Balak, the host of the show, is here with his son, Felix Balak, and of course, Jose Garvez. My name is Jesse Velez, and take it away, Dr. Balak.
Well, I'm changing plan. I enjoyed very much to listen to the Talking Heads. It really is one of, I think, the best tracks ever laid. And I just discovered recently that the greatest concert movie I believe ever made is
Stop Making Sense.
There are some good contenders out there, so I say it with much, yeah, I think really it captures the excitement of a live concert better than any I've ever heard of. So there was my fan moment. Otherwise we have two things, right? I was a fan of Talking Heads. I was
one
gushing
of two
over
fan moments, at least, of today.
Oh, right. That is true. So shall I just segue into the second fan moment? This would be our 111th episode. Nice. With the podcast, you know, I counted the podcast. I looked it up on WordPress.
So for those of you who have listened to the last, dozen, 10 shows or something?
Really? No.
You'd know about my father's infatuation with one of Bethesda's esteemed products. It was more than two.
We know. We made some comments about Fallout 4, which was a bit exciting, right?
Fallout 4.
So, you know, the fan will see I announced on our blog, I used the 111 as like the Vault 111. So there's a lot of the paraphernalia involved. Right. Let us shamelessly plug a multi-million-dollar company that aren't paying us or giving us any advantage for the privilege. So there's something wrong with that already. Oh dear. And finally, I believe we heard on the news that that Detroit teachers are calling in sick in mass in an attempt to strike. And that's an interesting topic. First of all, I want to just shout out there, right, and say that I think anybody engaged in such struggles is deserving. I think Detroit, we've touched upon it several times over the 2.5 years. We should go to it again. I see it as the canary in the coal mine. I mean, you want to see America's future if we don't do something seriously about it? Look at Detroit. It really exhibits kind of in a condensed case study all the diseases we are destined to suffer from painfully as a nation as a whole also. Right? So there they are, and they can't strike. I mean, there's no democracy, local democracy even there. It's really quite weird. It's been taken over by receivership, basically being bankrupt. So you have accountants and lawyers running, unvoted, running the city. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they don't have any government workers like teachers, don't have strike rights. And we always touch upon that when we come back, you know.
Well, that whole state is going down the tubes even further than what it was before, because right now in Flint, they're screaming about the water being contaminated. It's been contaminated for years, but the local government at Flint has done nothing.
It's like 11 years contaminated, something like that. It's like a decade long type of
process. And it's one among many places. Right? That's, I mean, always mention that, right, these things break out, and the danger is that if this somehow gets litigated, hey, let's be all optimistic. Let's say that somehow this thing gets solved. They clean up. Imagine the politicians that got paid, you know, through lobbyists in order to allow this, get like voted out of office. Some people go to jail, you know, the good old days, right? Rule of law, constitution. I mean, to wipe a tear. Fine. Let's not forget that this happens in many other places. It's an example.
Yeah.
They become famous all the time. I mean, for years we have the thing that brought to my attention now, favorite villains, in some circles, the Koch brothers, was precisely their particular use of local politics as well as national politics to allow them for generations to poison communities of poor black people in Georgia that are downriver from some of their main old power plants.
Yeah. And it makes you wonder why is it that this pollution never reaches Wall Street, right? Or never reaches like gentrify areas, and never is like totally not in my backyard type of attitude towards this type of waste. You know, like it definitely, I think, has a a distributional component, right? Like the dirtiest areas are always going to be the most harshly affected by other sorts of economic disparities.
Environmental justice sometimes, right? It's called because the poor disproportionately pay the price of the environmental damage.
Yeah, I mean, like, there is a whole bunch to talk about that. I mean, like, even if when you look at it at the world levels, right, like, most harshest impacts of global warming, climate change, and things like that are not going to be bestowed upon first world nations, right? It is the Guatemalas and the Haitis and all of these small, low-income developing countries, the ones that are actually going to be...
It's general. You know what? Yeah. I mean, there's a kind of a principle, I suppose, that holds pretty broadly, that the weaker you are, and of course, different societies might consider strength and weak. Today, we think weak, it's money, right? I mean, we're not class necessarily, right? Or religion so much, things like that, right? And not so long ago, there were other, you know, and even sometimes in the sickest of all places, a place I love and hate at the same time, Imperial Rome, part of the power was obviously military, but it was also all these like civic, you know, part of the amazing architecture they did was purely out of vanity and the need to kind of PR themselves all the time and provide services to people and sometimes to, the, you know, all of that. So civic duty to the wealthy and powerful can actually be used in a positive way, even in places that were... I mean, Rome fell on income inequality, by the way, which I know is your topic.
Yeah.
People don't often think that really, really, over the years, this struggle at the heart of Republic of Rome and then Imperial Rome was about inequality. People don't think about Julius Caesar being really killed because he was too popular. No joke here. I mean,
no.
Anybody interested in the history of Rome is going to go like, whoa, this guy's like way oversimplifying. Of course, I'm cracking one
That's
line.
That's what economists are good for. We simplify stuff, no?
I do remember that the real world is complex.
Yeah. We are more than aware of this, right?
So what about inequality?
So
he's gonna, you know, Felix is gonna, you know, that Felix deigns to join us when he. All right.
No. Never.
No, wait. Do you have a topic that you needed to be?
No.
Never mind.
You seem very chill right now.
Might be backing away from the mic a little bit because I have chocolate here.
You have chocolate, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Well, when you guys walked in, Jose and I were talking about actually the income inequality.
Right.
And I was actually using an example of how income inequality, as well as all the other economic issues, are usually singled out and used for one particular minority group to show that they're actually doing something when in reality they're not. And I'm going to get to the point. Point is that I was watching CNN. Of course, you know, we take CNN for whatever they say as, you know,
somebody
who knows.
Somebody watches CNN?
Yeah, somebody actually watches it. But they presented a poll because the last
the
couple weeks.
Week coverage of the.
Why?
The last couple weeks.
Nothing personal.
Okay. The last couple of weeks. And of course, I've mentioned this a couple of times and I know some people out there probably frown because they're probably going like, well, you know, 500 years, you know, we suffer and all that. But here's the reality of things. All politicians use any particular group, the one that's in fashion right now or the one that's more visually there to get their agenda across or to get hired. Okay. Now, the Academy Awards, the Oscars, okay, is sort of a reflective of what's going on today in politics. Okay. People
now,
are complaining. They're complaining. They're complaining that in the last couple of years, particularly this year, there was no black actors that won the Academy Awards or the Oscars or whatever that is. I don't pay attention to it. It just so happens that it was on the news. And CNN, I mean, to their credit, went ahead and put out, you know, statistics, you know, which we all know that can be manipulated. But as a Latino, I do know that this is for real. They were saying that, you know, this year has been horrendous for the Oscars, for the black community. But they were also saying that if it's bad for the black community, it's even worse for the Latino community. And what I've said on this show many other times is that it seems like instead of saying, good example, the phrase black matters. Well, I don't care. All lives matter.
Ah,
you know.
I tell you why the problem. I mean, but you're mixing two things really. First of all, the issue of non-white, right? Mm-hmm. And Latinos qualify.
Well, what I'm saying is when they talk about the issues, when they say that something's affecting this particular group, they just single out one particular group, and it's usually the black community. Now, I feel for the black community, but the Latino community also lives here. We are citizens. We pay taxes. Right. And we deserve to get some sort of recognition and equality.
John Oliver talked about it, about immigration, and I think he put it perfectly. It's the perfect example. I think that if you're in the United States and you pay taxes, you should be allowed to vote.
Right.
Because that's the perfect example of fiscalization without representation. Mm. And most immigrants, even many of the ones who got into the country legally, are actually paying taxes and paying social security.
Correct. So,
and they're not allowed to vote.
Right.
They're not allowed to have a voice in the political system. You know what I'm saying? So in that respect, the question then becomes, hey, how do we give them one?
Right.
Among the many justifiable complaints that we need to deal with to make the world a better place for all, you know, and we could even discuss of how it's even in the interests. I think people have made these arguments rather well for a couple of centuries now, I suppose, at least, that it's in the interest of white males to allow women and non-whites into the party, you know. Also, it's not even just to do the right thing.
But it's done as a country club, though.
But wait a second. It's really important issue you raise here. First of all, maybe here's an example how to deal with it. I mean, you know, the racism in Hollywood is horrendous. Is the racist, is the Latino community particularly even always has? There is the colonial background, we mustn't forget at all. And of course, there is the current rise, in anti-Latino feelings. Blacks can say that the only difference for them is that finally some white people are talking about what they've been living forever.
Right.
But here's the problem: why I'm straight up against all lives matter. I would agree to all non-pink. I don't know. Somebody must come up with a better wording. Non-white. I consider myself kind of beige.
I consider myself more like transparent.
Yeah. You got his vampirism for his Flemish mother.
But I mean, that phrase,
Brown lives matter.
Divisive.
I'm cool with brown lives matter under the agreement that blacks and Latinos and, you know, we're making it's not a biological concept, right? We know that. It's not scientific at all. It was invented, the whole concept of race, politically.
Basically, anywhere below the rubber gloves margin at the TSA.
Find one thing, but wait a minute. I'm excluding whites. Now, check it out. This is kind of controversial, but I'm hoping to try and explain myself properly. I'm saying, like, no, white life matters, black life matters. You know what? You make a point. I concede. Who am I to concede? But I agree, maybe it should have been opened to other groups who historically face a systemic injustice, right? Latinos qualify, you know, and yeah, you might say, well, some Latinos maybe are doing great, thank you very much, and have been for many generations.
But still, the phrase is very divisive, because when I hear that and I see the news that Latinos are being shot in the street and it's not being addressed, then that only tells me that the lines of discrimination has widened, and it's actually been so divisive between the Latino and black community because of that, because we have been left in the dark.
Yes. That is huge. I mean, I think we even talked about it, right, about this issue, and our local activists from Speak Up Florida and the people who do the different other groups. They are trying to fit together, you know, and respect each other's causes and form sufficient structure to do something about it. And it's very important. And it's, in fact, one of the key sources of frustration for many people who are trying to do kind of progressive activism, whatever you want to call it, is this tendency of people who really should show solidarity and fight together to just turn around on each other so quickly. And there's that competition of who's the most, who's been really the most under the boot in history. I suppose women win, really. Are black second? Probably. But how about Asians, by the way? We always forget Asians because they seem to be doing so well in the past, right?
Right. But of course, the general perception of the white American of Asians is that they're smart, they come to this country and they work hard. I mean, that's basically the image.
We forget that they were enslaved in California for
a long time. Hey, Shaheen.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going, huh?
But I mean, you see where I'm getting at. I mean, it's been divisive since I was born.
We have to stop it. We have to stand up and say it. Just like all the anti-Semitism that's come out in some of the more progressive kind of radical brown circles. And there are many people of color who are screaming blue murder about it. How can we do this? How can we do this?
Listen, the whole Jews control Wall Street. If you allow me to interpose for a second, I think kind of both of you are missing the point. The whole Black Lives Matter thing is not saying Black Lives Matter and only Black Lives Matter and nobody else matters. It's more along the lines of everyone who's socially disadvantaged matters as opposed to just white
people. So maybe we should call it brown lives.
It doesn't matter about the name. Everybody in America, at least in the last 30 years, has used specific examples for everything. We don't only want to punish BP for spilling oil. We want to punish everybody who does it.
But we don't punish anybody.
We shouldn't use descriptive words like black, white, or brown because I'm not black. I'm not black.
For the simple person
that's listening out there, Black Lives Matter, the person who's Latino is going like, well, I matter too.
Should we compare? Sure. Should we make the competition? I happen to think that if you made that calculation properly, you would probably get after women, Africans to be the broad.
But it's not a competition.
But what does it even mean?
I mean, like if you look at Latin American countries where Latinos are coming from, you still have systemic slavery.
Women are 51% of the population.
And the Maita, like in the
US, you know what I mean? So but in that Spain, sense, it's tricky.
Purely
numerically, and not only Spain, the guys who stay there after Spain.
Should we even do this calculation? Is it meaningful? Shouldn't we just?
I think personally that the people in power are the ones trying for us to make that calculation because they know the lesson. And the lesson is divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer.
And you see that Latinos get into conflict, say, for example, with the African American community when, say, for example, you have, I remember this case, I'm not entirely sure if it's in Detroit or Los Angeles, but it's this case
in which
there is an African American governor. Right.
Right.
That decides, there is a documentary on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
On destroying basically a Latino market because she is realizing that Latinos are actually exploiting the opportunity of have this like urban market, veggies market, right? And she basically displaces all these people to put a soccer field, stadium,
right?
Right. And it seems to me as one of the best examples of how is it that the people in power are just seeking to make these two groups enter into this type of conflicts, when in reality they would achieve way much more if they realize that they have one thing in common, and that's the oppressor.
Right, right. And that's what I'm saying.
We should all be concerned with all, like Mandela said and others before him, right? That you really have to look at all the injustices.
And that's what I'm saying. Those people in power who have influence, like the people at Hollywood doing the Oscars, because they do have political influence through money and everything else, and the media. Mm-hmm. They have been dividing us, and they're supposed to be the liberal ones.
90% of them are white men, so it shouldn't come as really a surprise, even if they do it unconsciously,
white men.
Giving them like the best benefit of the doubt.
Rich white
they
men.
They are all old, rich white men, you know. You can't expect much.
Well, actually, they calculated they made a statistic on that too. Who were they? And they're people who are white, over 62 years old of age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they probably watch Fox. But I want to finish the question. So you know, I just had to say that, but because that's their demographic, basically. Thank God. But CNN, we already gave them some hate today, so we're good, right?
Right, yeah. Right, right.
We don't forget MSNBC, right? We'll think of you in a minute. and anybody. But it's important, you know, you're talking about a kind of a brown, though I guess brown is not the best way for it, because then what about women, right? And what about, I'm not sure about it, but there is a thing in the memosphere or what have you that captures a real issue of privilege when you have people saying, and I don't think that's where you want to go. That's why I want to make sure, right? That the people saying not Black Lives Matter, it should read All Lives Matter, are kind of white entitled people that refuse to accept the fact of their entitlement, essentially, right? The idea is that it's okay. You don't have to have White Lives Matter because the police already cares about your life, apparently.
To paraphrase someone, most of those people would probably know intimately.
You're good.
With great entitlement comes great responsibility.
Well, yeah, that's a good phrase.
First, you have to accept the fact,
like,
you know?
400 and change years of, like, you know, living off the backs of slaves.
Yeah, what I'm highlighting is that the division is widening, And mm-hmm. it's because we're also participating with whatever's being handed down from upstairs. I mean, I've seen Latinos wearing a t-shirt that said Black Lives Matter, you know, but then community, their neighbors, their brothers, their sisters have been shot and got down. And I don't see mm-hmm. them saying or showing a t-shirt that says, hey, what happened to us? Latino lives matter.
Well, if they you do know, that, so they get deported, man.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't really want to go out and say, hey, Latino lives matter.
I'm hoping that Black Lives Matter, like the different movements that support that, would like agree that the Latinos who get shot.
I mean, it's almost reminiscent of the 60s when the Black Panthers were out there and you would have some person from a university, some white woman, tried to join the movements and sincerely believed in the movement of the Black Panthers, they were actually pushed off because they were white. You know,
I understand. I mean, there were a lot of white people that joined. I mean, especially Jews.
Right. Later on, when they saw that there was power in numbers. But at the beginning, they were very exclusive.
They were right to do so, though, because typically you get that kind of, you know, the man, if it's a woman's thing, the man, you know, you have to tread a little lightly and not too lightly, though. Let's all get into that kind of trigger moment. Yes, open everything up. Pop that pimple. My students know that rather elegant expression.
And that's what I'm getting at.
Absolutely.
But
open up the gate. That, you know, white man comes to save you. That's why Django Unchained, otherwise a splendid little romp, is kind of fundamentally racist, and I don't think Tarantino meant to. So in the best sense of the word, he also fell into the trap, right? Because he had to have a white guy to organize the black man to free himself. Hmm. And Avatar is a famous example. I use it. I probably will use it this semester in class, so be warned.
I will say this to the Latino community out there. It takes courage and we need to come out.
Hell yeah.
Plain and simple. And we need to make all the our members of our community, black, Asian, women, gay, make them aware that it's not just one group. It's all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Plain and simple. I mean, as long as we keep using these phrases,
and it's
I'm
all
sorry,
of,
it's
been the
happen.
Issue historically. This maintaining the solidarity is difficult, and sadly, you know, the forces of authoritarian kind of non-liberty have a better time of it. It's easier for them to create these kind of, you know, unifying physical slogans. We all watched with a certain knot in our stomach those three cheerleaders doing the Trump.
Creepy.
On the internet.
So creepy.
Know. No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah. They piled like
several
times.
Really weird.
Really creepy.
But now that you brought up Trump.
I turned the color down in black and white with the blonde hair.
Now that you brought up Trump. Now that you brought up Trump, you know what's really scary?
What?
Was yesterday Sarah Palin endorsing Trump?
Isn't that scary? That was wonderful.
Scary.
I mean, that's great.
I have to thank Donald Trump.
Yeah,
you're
man.
Doing an amazing job destroying the Republican Party.
I used to disagree with Benny a couple of weeks ago when he was saying like, Donald Trump shouldn't get elected. He's too crazy. And then I'm like, no, actually he should go. That might actually work.
And with Palin, all the better.
Oh, the president, man.
All the merrier.
Drill, baby.
Yeah. I'm really hoping that he does get elected by the Republican Party and then turns around and chooses her as the running mate.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen. You know what I mean?
You know,
I
think I probably would start believing again in a higher
There's
power.
There's only one thing bad about it. Now I'm going to, you know, give you a mental wedgie that then Hillary will win the president.
Yeah.
That's the
great.
So
she would be the first.
No,
woman
Hillary
president.
Will continue.
Honestly,
the business as usual corporate oligarchic agenda.
That's a really tricky
without
problem,
being noticed as such so much. This sad trap we find ourselves. Glenn Ford calls the more effective evil.
Talk about Latinos. Even if Bernie was instead of Hillary, Latino community would be
it
equally
matter,
messed up.
People.
Yeah, actually,
it's a bad
point, it's
reality
sad.
Show. Yeah. Frankly, sometimes it's better. Hence, maybe a Trump Palin ticket would be
very entertaining.
Entertaining, though, I still think that probably the Kardashians are a few levels above at this point still in terms of sophistication,
in terms of
political
polls,
meaningless
on the Republican polls. The Kardashians are higher,
right?
So, you know, there's better TV out there. Honestly, focus on local elections and on getting like
yeah,
you know.
But,
Latino no community.
I don't think there is something impressive, Benny. And I think that that's where it stops being entertaining and starts being problematic. And is the amount of following they have. And say, you don't see, I don't know, any other reality show having so much resonance with people's beliefs. You know what I mean? And the fact that people like Ted Cruz are actually establishing and eloquently communicating someone's beliefs out there is highly problematic for me.
Right.
You know
Same
what I mean?
Here. Same
because
here.
If, hey, if someone is going to tell me, hey, I believe in Jediism and I believe in Star Wars and Obi-Wan Kenobi expresses my beliefs, then I'm going to be like, all right, that's fine.
Cool.
But you're a minority. That's cool. I respect that. You know what I mean? But when a large percentage of America
are they tax exempt?
Actually, yeah, man, that would
well,
be that would
I think
be
they deserve to be just yeah. any fan site.
No, they're not.
Taxes,
actually, I was thinking about that when we were talking about Latinos. When we were talking about how is it that immigrants do pay taxes? Mm. How come is it that churches don't?
Right, exactly.
And they get such a large voice
Thank
and
you.
Audience
I've
in
been
government.
Saying, I've been saying that for the longest time
and
too.
And Latinos don't.
In this program, they need to be taxed.
Seriously.
Plain and simple.
Yeah,
all these churches.
It's George one Carlin of the, had a great joke about it. He used to say something like, "Hey, if they want to play in the political game, they should pay the
right.
entry fee."
Right.
It's still the law, by the way. They're supposed to be very careful in their actions, but of course they violate it regularly, and then it becomes a political game where regulators are not allowed to stop them from doing that. Because then it becomes a kind of, they're pursuing, Christian faith, they're hurting our Christian faith.
It's a touchy topic.
But you're not supposed to theoretically, legally, and I think it's a great example of one of those ghost ships of the Constitution, you know, ideas that were necessary, in the 1800s, precisely to avoid the government's playing religious cards. And now we've become a sad joke a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Constitution and the laws here are basically observed out of convenience, plain and simple. Because the Ted Cruz thing, hey, they gave Obama so much of a hard time, and he was actually born in Hawaii. Ted Cruz was not born here.
He was, Canadian? No.
He was born in Canada.
Yeah, he's Canadian.
Right, he's Canadian. But then again, William Shatner, is Canadian, and we let him drive the... we let him drive the Enterprise, but then again, that's not the United States government. I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander, as much as the Republicans want to cringe on it now.
The catch is when, once you start like using institutions for the convenience of certain groups, right?
Right.
Like that capture is what I think everybody kind of disapproves of, and it's definitely problematic. And ultimately, any group that is suppressed is going to be trying to fight
Talking about suppression, give us the stats on the income inequality.
All right. So, I wanted to talk about income inequality, but I realize it's kind of like a pop topic nowadays, right? There is like that Netflix documentary.
And just when we're trying to get some structure, here I am with my, 5-pound demolition hammer.
All right.
It's gone. We're coming back for a second, though. The whole inequality. It's not Bernie Sanders that has raised the issue of inequality. Nobody talked about inequality for like decades. Since the Cold War in this country, the world was not used. Note the campaigns of President Obama in specifically because we know about that. Others surely also. I'm sure it goes back. Not the word poor or poverty, the P word, not mentioned, not once in the greatest recession this country has seen since the Great Depression and, okay. So talk about changing the rhetoric, which to me is the only thing I really care about when I look at Sanders. Sorry, Sanders supporters.
Yeah, Benny, but I
like that he talks about it, but it's Occupy movement that invented this. It's them. They deserve the credit for the Americans talking about inequality. Whatever you think about inequality.
And I mean, like, there is a whole set of radical economists.
But I'm talking real public that
like
the people in the streets talk about it.
And some of them, like Wolf, was with the Occupy movement yelling out for the generation's problems, you know what I mean?
But the mainstream media has declared them a failure, like a few years back, and people have like forgotten and moved on. I don't want to say that the accomplishment that some people would say feeling the burn, right?
Yeah.
I just want to remind them that that was also a grassroots, unorganized, in the street by people with very little power and support getting beaten up by the police.
And
as usual, they lead progress.
Interestingly enough, even the people who led progress historically in the 20th century, like I'll give an example, Robert Solow. Want to have some fun in YouTube? Watch Robert Solow and Paul Krugman talking about income inequality. Robert Solow, for those of you out there, if you don't recognize the name, basically is the guy who came up with economic growth and the classical economic growth model.
Heavy hitter.
And this guy is arguing, hey, actually, my model has been misused, and actually, income inequality matters. Like, the question is a problem kind of like, hey, I can show you what's truth. It's up to you to believe it.
Yeah, check it out. What Rosé is telling here is that basically the guy who invented the concept that with a lot of math of a rising tide raises all ships, right?
Yeah.
This very concept that if we can just grow, we'll have enough of a bigger pie makes the people that even get the small part of the pie get a bigger slice, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's bigger.
Trickle down type of
thing. Right,
deal.
All the trickle down. The guy who invented the damn thing is yelling and screaming, actually for some time, I think, on multiple levels that, wait a minute.
Don't abuse the model I invented and actually realize that distribution can be a problem. And it is a problem, right?
Don't turn it into a religion or a kind of pundit's kind of marketing slogan to use in electoral campaign.
Which,
and such, to
sadly,
manipulate people.
Tragically, to some extent, I think is being used that way.
Right.
Without
is.
Actually talking about the issues that really matter behind income inequality. And I think that one of them actually is this. Don't you find ironic, Benny, that as you said, right, poverty stopped being part of the economic agenda, right, at the political level, and economic growth is. And the guy who came up with economic growth is saying, hey, stop worrying about growth, care about distribution and poverty and inequality. Right. I find it like the irony behind that whole process is fascinating.
That's why China is failing. Hey, here's something very much on the news. Everybody's like scratching their head. Oh, my God. The markets have just fallen like some 2.5%, I believe, today or something, which is a lot. So all this, oh my God, what's happening in China? Well, we've known the Communist Party of China has known what's happening in China for decades and have been every 5 years when they have their kind of big communist conference thing, right, with the flags and... they talk about, oh, but we must foster internal growth. In the long run, we must foster internal growth. They've been saying it since the 80s, you know? I mean, that's what made the Chinese miracle kind of petter off for the past 10 years, too.
It's like the first time they have slowed down in economic growth in like 30 years, something like that.
Yeah, and they've converted to, right. They're converting heavily to services, and that's also the experience of those fortunate enough to go there, you know, and see. But again, they don't have enough rich people. I mean, they have 200 million people in that modern system, including basically sweatshop workers. I'm including them here as people that might maybe see a higher income. Maybe their kids will go to school, you know, instead of, what about the other 800 million people?
Life has gone to hell
in the past decade.
A lot of people,
this is Shane, by way,
a lot of people forget to mention that the Chinese are not declining in growth. They're still growing.
Right.
It's just a little bit slower.
Right. Yeah.
So they're growing.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that what Ben is saying is like, it's the first time that has slowed in a really long time.
At least, the fear is finally.
That's something to be scared about if you care about.
But they're still growing, which means, you know, it's so much better than the U.S.
That's, I meant it in the context of the inequality. I mean, their problem is that as you grow, if you're going to go with this kind of like the Chinese did and some other, the only one to succeed probably, right? Or maybe someplace, maybe you can fill in terms of golf because you have, you know me already. I mean, you know, funny countries there, you know, in the sense that they're either very new or have specific structures and a lot of oil and gas. But generally, if you develop in the Chinese case, right? So they did a lot of funding from abroad. We've already said in the show, let's say it again, that when we talk about Chinese taking our jobs, much more often than not, this is an American company that is creating a company in China or signing up with it more typically with a subsidiary or a company in China, creating a relationship by which to outsource that labor to China. So that you can
like
say
Apple,
it's our elites doing it to us. When we're talking about like, you know, the Chinese have taken our jobs, not as using racism, kind of, you know, nationalism. No, it's not. It's our elites are good American, you know,
let's talk a little bit about that.
But like, they're not spreading it, right? Yeah. That's their problem. Yeah. It stays in the community. So some people are getting rich and middle class and rich, and there's China is so big that it's a significant chunk of people. Mm-hmm. But the majority is left behind. They no longer have those protections that communism offered, like healthcare, even if not a very good one, or whatever, housing, jobs. They're left alone, like in the old days of China when they had famines. Again, so it's a retreat, right? So you got to spread the wealth in order to maintain the growth. I'm saying that is a kind of a.
So I mean, like a popular topic we've talked about in this program in the past and even today, right? Is social categories, right? Mm. And you have race, and you have gender. And you have like big social categories, basically ways in which we can classify people. The reason why I'm bringing up income inequality is because I think that that's the language we can use to start talking seriously about another social category that sometimes I feel gets pushed aside if you focus on race and gender. And they're all interrelated and they're all obviously all important, right? But the one category I really wanted to talk about, and I think that being that we're economists, we're going to have a lot to talk about, is class. Right? Class. It's as simple as that. Why don't we address the issue of class? If Latinos and African Americans share something in common, it's in many instances that they belong to the same economic class.
Right.
Right? So I think that that's why I think income inequality matters and wealth inequality matters, right? They're not the same thing, people, but so it's important to notice
right.
the difference.
Yeah, right. I mean, income
right?
wealth captures all
income
that kind
of long-term
stuff.
Income is how much you make every month. Wealth is your stock of
wealth
is,
if you want to get scared, it's right. wealth that you read. For if you're talking of African Americans, that basically, on average, African Americans own, ready for it? Nothing.
No wealth. Zero wealth.
They have nothing. You know, on average, of course, there's a couple of millionaires out there.
Yeah,
yes?
Outliers, we call them, right?
Nothing.
Yeah, it's creepy.
Know?
It's creepy.
No property.
The statistics exist on this stuff.
Whites, the average pulls us up nicely into like a 50 grand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know it sounds a bit low for most people too.
But I mean,
wealth, that's the value of your house and your cars, of course, minus your debt, right? And what you have in the bank, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was a quick and rough definition, right?
And, I mean, but I think that it attacks everybody, Benny. I mean, like, when you look, I think it was 2 weeks ago around that I saw the Pew Research Center doing some stuff on the average American does not even save $1,000 in savings, right? So if you think about class, it's highly problematic for every social category pretty much. And it's going to affect more harshly the social categories that we've been talking about in this show that are even more oppressed and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So out of thinking about explanations for this issue, I think that it is worth to bring in a fellow economist that has talked about this issue and actually has done the numbers and look at the numbers. And I wanted to, it's a bit longer, but I think that we can start talking about it and then we can continue the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to bring out Piketty.
Yeah.
You know, Thomas Piketty.
Famous. Superstar.
Incredibly famous, popular economist. And what I realize is that out there, a lot of people don't realize what he actually did.
Ah. Yeah, so, that's definitely worth. I mean, I think we've had bits and pieces like that or whatever, but absolutely worth it. Let's just go. Yeah.
And basically all I wanted to talk about was what Piketty did.
Well,
was,
wait a minute, just in case, right? So he wrote this book.
Book now, more popular than Harry Potter. Like
maybe,
more popular.
No, well, it might be pushing it.
Then I should have known.
Actually it got like bestseller in Amazon. Yeah,
no,
and
right.
Like
no, it's
that.
Ridiculous.
It's like ridiculous.
Of course, I doubt how
star.
Many people have actually read it
actually
is another
read
matter.
21st
though,
century, right?
That information but... is, that's a whole other topic, is that there's been a big bump, especially in YouTube and Amazon apparently for a while already, in the resolution of the data that they get. So they don't just know what we watch, but how long we watch it and exactly how we watch it and everything, which is fascinating on multiple levels, and we'll get there another time. But so Piketty wrote this book, Capital in the 21st Century, which is like this, what, 500-600 page, tome.
Yeah.
In economic history and macroeconomics, you don't think of that as, you know, oh my God, that thing is going to outsell Harry Potter. You know?
Yeah.
No, you don't think that. And maybe, I don't know, that still sounds a little bit out there for me.
It was quite
but
impressive.
But a big hit. The only other one before it in modern times, at least in the 20th century, let's say, you know, would be maybe Freakonomics, that also made a bit of a, for a very, very different, in a very, very different way. But that was particularly a kind of a sophomoric little.
And it was really pop
clever,
and accessible, not
thing.
A
yeah.
600 page tome.
Exactly.
Right?
And people are at least buying it and talking about it. So it's really impacted at least the intellectual elite tremendously. And what does even that mean is another matter, and beyond, I think. I think the people on the streets have been talking it for a long time, but now they have a respectable statistician, you know, econometrician.
Actually putting numbers into
it. To really kind of, right. Here it is. You are essentially saying you were right, I think.
So I think that his contribution can be separated in two. Mm. On one hand, he collected data on income. And the type of data he collected, he did his homework. He looked at historical data. So he went all the way back into 1913. Actually, I have my little table right here that I'm reading. And he goes back all the way to 1913 and looks at the tax records, pretty much. Like the type of data collection where you go into a library and you have to wear these type of special suits in order to pick up one piece of paper because the whole environment
so
your,
the
is toxic.
The acidity of
you know
your
know
skin
I mean?
Will eat
it's
up the
something
scrolls,
really,
right?
Really, really impressive data work, right? And he collected for multiple countries, China included, Sweden included, Japan included, UK, the US. Mm. And he tried to compare and see. Now, he's very honest about it. He's really transparent about his data, and he argues, well, if you think about it, even in tax records, we would underestimate the effects of inequality, right? Because the rich usually tend to avoid taxes more effectively.
Right.
Always, right?
And that's almost, well, I don't know if anyone's guess is the right expression, but he is being very sound in terms of precisely an economic historian in picking the worst numbers possible to make his point. So if he made his point with these numbers, imagine all those trillions held in discrete little places around the world.
Yeah, let's talk about the Cayman Islands.
He didn't even count that. So
bank account.
This is an underestimate of inequality.
And what he basically shows in the plot I have in front of me, it's pretty much that all the way till 1949, income inequality looks pretty bad. Actually, basically the top income shares that go up to the top 1% of income, basically how much of
income,
the,
again, which is another very significant underestimation
reported
because all the stuff you
income, reported income.
All
right?
The stuff anybody inherits is not being counted.
It's not
so
being counted.
All those castles and villas, forget it.
And also really important, in this particular graph, I'm not including capital gains.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like the worst of the worst number, and you can still already see the trend, right? Mm-hmm. And the trend is basically a U, right?
Where going down, hitting bottom, rising up.
In 1945, it goes down and down, 1949, and ironically, from 1950 to 1979, 1982, income inequality, the income share that's going to the wealthiest, 1%, is below 10%, right? You probably have seen this graph in Inequality for All by Robert Reich, right?
And
a lot of
suspension
people.
Bridge,
yeah,
right?
It's creepy looking, right? Around 1985, after Reagan, right? A very important character here. We see that income inequality rises again all the way up to 1929 levels. Right. And we're talking about Rockefeller's time. We're talking about Robert Barron's time, right? Income inequality nowadays is up at those levels.
Right.
So on one hand, first Piketty's contribution, getting that data.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can see that data. We can look at the century and say, hey, this century started with high inequality. It dropped down after World War II. Mm-hmm. It went back up ridiculously since the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it has stayed up.
It's funny how long it took it. I mean, and now here we can, and we will, and we have, you know, we can tell stories till we're blue in the face a thousand times over, of course, but, and we should. And some of those stories can be verified to a point. So there's a lot of interesting, like, for example, even think of one of the things that came to mind to me as those 50s, right? 50s, such a rigid, oh my God, right?
Yeah.
McCarthy and all that, right? Period in America. How come they're kind of, we have the socialistic government? In a sense, so one could say, well, maybe to keep Americans happy so they don't look across to the other side to make sure that America is the country of the good life and others aren't. Maybe when elites are concerned that the people are unhappy, they respond. So we should maybe get a little bit more unhappy today.
But I also think that there is another element to it, you know, like, and the idea is,
truly,
I think that what Piketty talks about is, why is it that it increased?
Yeah.
Why is it that it increased? And that drives me to my second Piketty contribution. Mm-hmm. I think that what Piketty looked at was at the different theories that exist out there about why income inequality increases, right? And you can boil them down to really two big groups, right? The first one is political economy, right? The studying conflict and class and labor and things like that, right?
And that's in the most essential kind of, if you happen to have some power, that gives you a tremendous advantage to get even more power, which then makes you get even more power, right? That's, I know, that seems a little, but that's maybe the essence of it all.
Now, there is another theory, right? And the other theory is the one that most mainstream economics and neoclassical economics is putting out there, right, which has to do with technological change and level of openness, right? So technical change refers nothing but, hey, incomes got different because people's education got different, right? And people with skills, right, quote-unquote skills, right, actually got richer, and people without those skills got
inevitability. Right? People are not catching up with the needs for developed skills. In this case, right.
And the other the other theory coming from the mainstream side is openness, right? Basically, companies went abroad and exploited other countries' workers that are not willing to work for the same salaries, and that's why our salaries in the United States remain stagnant for the past 40 years.
Right.
Now, here is the catch. What Piketty does, and the creative side of Piketty, was to look at two sets of countries. Countries in which the political economy forces stayed the same.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, people were belonging to the same amount of unions throughout all time. And also, very important, monopolies. On oligopolies weren't as strong.
Right.
All right.
And he created some kind of index, right, for that.
No, he actually compared unionization rates.
Monopoly concentration rates.
Right? It's just like out of your labor force, how many people are in a union, right?
So he literally regressed on all the different.
And here is what he finds: three countries in which things remain the same in terms of unionization rates and amount of monopolies they have, or oligopolies, consolidation, we call it in economics, right? France, Sweden, and Japan. Relatively non-consolidated economy, relatively competitive. A lot of people are unionized in those countries, right? Now, countries in which in the 80s, those two things change. The UK and the US.
But that changed. I mean, I'm not going to be, I mean, we're filtering into like a seminar or just hang out and chat mode a little bit. But I'm thinking, really? I mean, France lost all of unionization in the eighties. Yeah, you know, they elected in 1980 a socialist, François Mitterrand, that turned out to be
Here is the catch, Benny. France has the same level of productivity per worker actually than the US.
Sure. Yeah,
and they are way much better treated as worker,
right? Germans come to mind typically as the example of highly productive as well as very well treated, highly unionized.
Highly unionized, right? And also, I think that the other important aspect is the consolidation of the economy. Big companies,
right?
Yeah. Big banks, big oil companies, everything important according
to... And the structure is important, of course.
Right?
I mean, I'm being an institutionalist, a little bit on that one, right? I mean, that matters. I'm thinking already in America, you have that, of course, that revolving door and the lobbying. So you have independent for-profit corporations controlling government, while the French, or of course, the origins of this, the Chabol, right?
The
South Korean, Swedish, those kind of social democracies. Maybe in some sense, America in the 60s and 50s and 70s until it started
actually,
to go bad.
Yeah.
There you have a kind of a planned kind of the government officials elected sit together with business leaders and somehow negotiate their bonuses as well as the interests of the nation. Not perfect, perhaps, but it tends out to work much better.
Well, basically, the moral and the punchline of my story is that Piketty finds that countries that are similar in terms of their level of openness and the level of productivity per worker, but that saw lower unionization rates and higher consolidation of the economy are countries that tend to see higher income inequality.
Yeah.
So at the core of income inequality, you do not have issues of what the neoclassical mainstream econ story would be. Oh, this happened because everybody's differently skilled.
Right.
This happened because they are taking our jobs away in other countries. No, people, like what actually happened was, hey, workers got to lower rights
power
because they are not as unified.
Right.
And big corporations turn bigger.
You know, I got it. This is a big
concentration
deal and important. And sometimes you have that. It's one of those things, right? Where the socialists like unions, the capitalists don't like unions, right? And it's about identity politics and all that. And we're getting into the election year. So let's delve on this a little bit because it's really important. So this is one of the big duh moments.
Yeah.
Right. For me, back in like, I don't know if it was early, you know, somewhere between undergrad and graduate. So, I mean, I was a little slow perhaps to catch on. It was a long time ago. So it's obvious. I mean, if you have a market, let's assume a standard kind of market from the textbook, right? Which incidentally, that's what Jose was mentioning, neoclassical, that textbook that if you've ever seen a textbook in economics, it's almost certainly about 99% sure you've seen a book that is only one kind of economics, a kind that was born, not out of nothing, of course, after World War II, essentially. So it's just one way of looking at the economy that was considered to be kind of odd, really, and not popular in the 20s and 30s, and managed to totally dominate a few years later, and that's another story altogether why. So that's those neoclassical guys. And that's the stuff that you almost always get from the television to the classroom. But not here at Rollins. Here you get that too, but then you get some others too. A real representation of what economists out there in the world think for real. Not the now can I say MSNBC? No, can I hear MSNBC? Not the MSNBC or the Fox version of it. They love the neoclassical. At any rate, so union. Listen, it's a dumb moment. Imagine a market, a free market, a beautiful capitalistic market. Come people who want a job, right, and have whatever skills they have, or not perhaps. Come people who need these people to work, and they need the particular people. There's so many problems, right? As if, you know, I need a computer programmer. Oh, no, I can't. So why don't I take, like, instead 30, guys trying to get a day's labor in a hardware store instead. That's kind of one of the key assumptions of the labor market chapter in the neoclassical book, isn't it?
Yeah. It's,
right? It's a unit of labor.
Yeah.
You know, a program is just more of it.
Workers are as homogeneous as tomatoes, right?
That is so stupid it hurts.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's mathematically stupid. I mean, how do they even, I mean, maybe, never mind that. The point, really, I'm just saying. What? Yeah. Anyway, but it matters precisely because then we go on the analysis with those stupid assumptions and our conclusions are actually quite respectable sounding and even kind of patriotic and wonderfully sounding too. And then they're doubly dangerous, of course, because they're just as stupid as they were in the beginning, even more so probably kind of to the power.
Yeah.
But anyway, think about it. They get together to negotiate a wage, right? Negotiation. That's what we call a free market, right? When the commissar from Russia comes and tells
you
shall now produce 3 tons of nails, that is not a free market. That is command, right? That's,
yeah? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, guess what? You got to imagine that single worker coming to get a job against the corporation, and most of our business operations are big, at least, you know.
McDonald's,
the vast
Walmart.
The vast majority of certainly the economic activity. We have a lot of small businesses in America, though they are defined, I believe, as under 1,000 workers, which is pretty big already. Hmm. Or is it 500? Senior moment.
And most of their goal, and here's something about small business. I don't know really too much about the culture of small business in America, but what I've noticed from people who own them, from people who develop them, is that their dream is not to make their business a large corporation.
No.
Their dream is to get bought by one of the largest corporations.
Yeah. Well, right? because essentially the other option is being crushed by one of the other corporations,
exactly,
right? So
exactly.
they're biding their time. The notion that made capitalism great,
even in the tech industry,
right?
Where we think, oh my God, innovation and stuff like that. Right. Even in the tech industry.
It's not I want my name on that product well after I die. That spirit is kind of long gone. Long gone.
Oh, entrepreneurs.
We'll go back to deal with this whole, I think the dumb moment of unions, and thus go back to this is a point that Piketty proved to us, perhaps.
Yeah, pretty much.
Effectively. Yeah. Do the legal stuff.
Me.
Well, yeah. The legal stuff.